On this week's prequel episode, we follow up on our Hellraiser listener polls and preview Quest for Camelot. Hello and welcome back to This Film is Lit, the podcast where we talk about movies that are based on books. It's another prequel episode. Normally I rush through this because we got so much to get to, but we don't actually have all that much to get to this week. But there's not really any reason to dilly-dally, so we're going to jump. Let's do this. You can give feedback on this. We are going to make a post about it. Let us know if you would at all be interested in being involved in a Facebook group for this podcast.
Yeah.
So I realized the other day that we have never had, we don't have a Facebook group for this podcast. And for some reason, I've never thought about it. We just have like our page for the actual podcast. For some reason, I've never thought about it, which is wild because I engage. It's like the only thing I do on Facebook is engage in Facebook groups with from like podcasts and stuff that mm-hmm. I listen to. It's literally the only reason I have Facebook. Like I don't.
Yeah, I'm not podcast groups because right. I don't really listen to podcasts, but I pretty much only groups.
Yeah.
Is all I do on Facebook now.
And so I don't know why we hadn't thought about it until now, but we're probably going to make it either way. But we just wanted to gauge some interest anyways. And think that we were thinking like that may be a better avenue for getting more feedback on episodes and stuff like that, because then it's, anyways.
Yeah. Well, and for some reason with like the feedback posts in particular,
yes.
Facebook is like the reach that we get on those posts specifically
terrible.
Is such trash that I, for some reason, Facebook is like, no.
Yeah.
Every time
to the point where we're not even sure how much the lack of engagement on Facebook specifically in regards to feedback is due to people not being, not being interested in commenting versus nobody seeing those posts and just forgetting about it or whatever. So,
it's just like not coming up in people's feeds.
Yeah. So anyways, we're going to look into that. Let us know, like I said, if you want to comment on this post episode or episode post or whatever. On Patreon or Facebook or wherever you follow us and let us know. Facebook would probably be the main place where we would do that. We engage with people on Patreon and stuff like that, but Facebook has the infrastructure set up for like groups like that. So we're probably going to do that here in the coming weeks or so. Just wanted to mention that up top. So look out for that coming soon. But as always, it's time for our patron shout outs.
I put up with you because your father and mother were our finest patrons, that's why.
No new patrons this week, but we do have our Academy Award-winning patrons, and they are Nicole Goble, Harpo Rat, Nathan, Vic Apocalypse, Matilde, Cottonwood Steve, Teresa Schwartz, Ian from Wine Country, Kelly Napier, Gratch, Just Gratch, Shelby Says Help Me Raise Money for Palestine with Arctic Fox Copywriting on Instagram, and That Darn Skag. Thank you all very much for your continued support. We really appreciate it. Katie, it's time to see what the people had to say about Hellraiser.
Yeah, well, that's just like your opinion, man.
All right. On Patreon, we had 3 votes for the book and 0 for the movie. We had one comment from Kelly Napier who said, I find it interesting that Clive Barker wrote a book, decided to turn that book into a movie, decided to write and direct the movie himself so it would truly encapsulate his vision, and yet changed so many things from the book. Did he dislike what he wrote that much?
It is interesting considering that was the whole point.
Yeah.
Of doing it, of him directing.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, it wasn't so much that so much was changed as that was that on previous adaptations, he just didn't like how they came out. So,
right.
But yes.
Personally, I liked it better in the book that Kirsty was Rory's lover and not his daughter. And Rory is a much better name than Larry. Although for the first little bit of the book, I didn't realize Rory was a boy. Must be all the Gilmore Girls I've watched over the years.
Oh, that is her name. Yeah. That's funny because I always, for me, Rory is a dude because of Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I forgot. Yeah, in Gilmore Girls, she is Rory.
I like reading horror books over watching horror movies because the images in my head are always more grotesque and scary than what ends up being shown on screen. I could really imagine Frank being stuck halfway between this world and another one, and him slowly coming back into form with each murder Julia commits on his behalf. I thought that the movie made him fully formed with too much power too soon.
I assume the reason they did that in the movie is they got him to full walking around dude status pretty quickly so mm-hmm. that they didn't have to keep doing a little puppet or I don't know how they did like the part where he was like a little skeleton corpse flopping around or whatever. If they had somebody who had like their limbs amputated, I have no idea. But my guess would be that they just, like for practical purposes and just for him to be more of an interesting, like involved character. In a book, it's easy. You can just, you know, you can show or say, you know, describe all of that and let people imagine it. But in the movie, you actually have to do it. So, yeah, I think that was probably a practical choice to make him
kind of be
fully formed enough to be walking around like almost immediately.
I also liked in the book how we got more background about who the Order of the Gash is and what Rory / Larry, I think maybe Frank, Frank was looking for when he summoned them initially. It felt rushed in the movie. The one detail I did appreciate in the movie was that when Larry was Larry, his eyes were blue, and when Frank was Larry, his eyes were brown.
Oh.
What a clever thing to include.
I did not notice that.
That is cool, though.
Yeah.
They could have left everyone being British, because England just naturally gives creepy horror vibes.
Absolutely. No reason to change it.
Clive Barker has always been a favorite author of mine, and this novella did not disappoint the high standard I hold him to. A+ work, 9 out of 10, 2 very enthusiastic thumbs up. The book gets my vote.
Thank you, Kelly.
Over on Facebook, we had 3 votes for the book and 0 for the movie. We had a comment from Warren who said, "I had to choose the book. I was super excited to see you covering Clive Barker. I've been fascinated with Hellraiser since I worked in an autograph shop that had Doug Bradley come in to do an in-store signing and picked the movie up on video, VHS, to find out what his role was."
He's Pinhead. Mm. Just for people who weren't aware, Doug Bradley plays Pinhead.
The book was...
I love the idea, though, of an autograph shop.
Yeah.
Not a card shop or a memorabilia shop, specifically an autograph shop. Maybe you meant a memorabilia shop, and but I was like, I'm interested to know, Warren, if it was literally like the point was we sell famous people's autographs,
mm-hmm.
or if it was a broader memorabilia shop that also had like autographs, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? This is interesting. I've never heard of an autograph shop specifically.
Yeah, me either. The book was always going to win for me, as Clive's writing just hits me in a special way. I can only call it art for lack of a better term. And like you said, the film seems to misunderstand the characters. Though I don't fully blame Barker for this, as it seems to be an issue with some of his other adaptations, like Nightbreed 2, where the money people don't understand how the monsters aren't the bad guys, so they sort of get forced in that role with Barker trying to push back.
I will say for this movie, from what I have read and seemed to find, is that that wasn't the case with this, that seemingly... most of, if not all of the changes, other than like the England thing, were Barker's choices or you know, not like studio led choices. I read somewhere on a Reddit post or something, because somebody was asking specifically in relation to the ending and the Cenobites becoming the final villain that Kirstie has to defeat. And somebody was talking about how it kind of undercuts the point of the movie, and somebody had speculated like, oh, I think that was probably like a studio change or something, or something to do with them when the studio gave them more money and they came in at the end or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And somebody in that thread, and now this is one comment on Reddit, so take it with, you know, as much salt as you should. But that person said that they had read an early version of the script that was written before the, like, prior to production.
Yeah.
That had that ending in it.
Hmm.
And so it seemed to them, potentially, they were pushing back on the idea that that was a studio mandate and was, in fact, what Barker wanted to do. They're saying that that was
so
Barker's choice. Potentially. Potentially. Again, it was one Reddit comment that I found. So
yeah. Huh. Getting back to Warren's comment, creative issues do seem to be why he hasn't directed much. I remember hearing an interview with him saying something along the lines of, why bother fighting to get something made with other people who don't understand and waste 2 years of my life when I can just sit and write something?
It's interesting. I wonder if later that experience of directing, I wonder if that came from later in life and when he had maybe directed a couple more things. Because, again, from seemingly the comments I read about him directing this movie, he had very positive things to say about the experience of directing this movie. Mm-hmm. But it's also, who knows? Maybe that those comments were taken out of context, or and he did have broader negative feelings about it. And maybe there was more studio pushback or, you know, micromanagement than it seemed like. Who knows? But that was part of the whole concept, the whole idea of making this specific movie, was that he could make it cheap enough that he, as a first-time director, could make it without a ton of studio oversight and input and that sort of thing. And he could make the movie he wanted to make.
Instead, it seems he's had better prospects just having other people make movies based off his works. Candyman, Midnight Meat Train, and Dread are three I'd recommend that, hot take, might be contenders for better than the book.
Interesting. I've heard Candyman's good. I've never actually heard of the other two.
Yeah.
But Candyman is kind of a classic of horror
cinema. Yeah, I've heard Candyman's good. I've never seen it.
I haven't seen it either.
Midnight Meat Train is a hell of a title.
Hell of a title.
As for the Hellraiser series itself, I recommend watching the first four. They tell and complete a whole story together. Sadly, Kirstie does not become one of the Cenobites, though in the comics they do run with that idea.
Say sadly. I'm not sure. Based on this first movie, I'm not sure I left it going, man, I hope she becomes a Cenobite one day. But.
Originally, at the end of Hellraiser 2, Julia was to take over as the new Pinhead, but the actress wasn't interested, which is a shame.
That's interesting.
From 5 onwards, the films become standalone adventures, and the Cenobites change to being figures that punish the wicked, and the whole thing is more morality tales. One day, I hope we get a version of the Cenobites closer to the book version. I was surprised you didn't mention much on the difference between the Cenobites from book to film. The recent remake has versions closer to the book, but I feel they miss the beauty and the grotesque, for lack of a better term.
I would agree with that. In particular, I remember thinking when I was reading about, before having seen anything of the movie and having watched a trailer or anything, the only Cenobite that I was aware of was Pinhead.
Yeah.
That I had seen. I knew there were other ones, but I think the only one I had visually seen was Pinhead. And so I was reading stuff about the movie and reading about the whatever, I don't remember her name, but the female one, who in the movie has like all that metal stuff on her face, and then her neck is like splayed open in a way that is very reminiscent of like a vagina.
Yeah.
But I was expecting her to be sexier. Not like in a, but just like based on the descriptions of the movie and stuff I was reading and about how it was like, the Cenobites were kind of these incarnations of like, you know, like pure like hedonism and stuff like that. And it just, my thought was like, oh, she's going to look like the Borg queen from Star Trek Insurrection or whatever. And I was kind of surprised at how ugly they all were.
Yeah.
Other than Pinhead, who's kind of just a dude with pins in his head.
Right.
And I think this kind of speaks to what he's talking about. They don't really have like a hideous beauty. They're just kind of hideous in this movie, at least. And from what I've seen of the remake, because I did watch that trailer because I was curious, they definitely lean more into like the high, being somewhere, but like this weird amalgamation of like hideous and beautiful and horrifying and sexy kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a bunch of a bunch of fake stupid controversy when the remake came out because they cast a trans woman as Pinhead in that, which is interesting in a lot of different ways, but
yeah. Side note, The Scarlet Gospels, the sequel book, is definitely more like a sequel to the movies than to The Hellbound Heart. And yes, Poe is a big influence on Barker. Hope that's not too long a rant. Love the show, even if I forget to comment most episodes. All the best.
You're not alone. A lot of people forgot this week, but thank you.
Our other comment on Facebook was from Paige, who said, I don't have an opinion on either the book or the movie, which greatly upsets me. My to-read and to-watch pile is extensive, and the overwhelm is real. However, I do have an opinion on Clive Barker. I met him 1 year at a horror con, and that man was the sweetest guy I've ever met. He had a whole tent set up around him because he was selling exclusive art he made as well. And the mind on this man made me want to stay and just ask him questions. He genuinely seems so thrilled to know that people are fans of his work, whether it was his books, movies, or artwork. I'm so glad I went to that convention that year. Meeting him and Tony Todd became a core memory of mine that I'll hold dear for the rest of my life.
That's very cool. Tony Todd is Candyman.
Oh.
Among other things. He's been in lots of stuff over the years. You would recognize him if you don't. If the name doesn't ring a bell, you
absolutely... Yeah, the name does not ring a bell.
You would recognize... He just passed away recently. He was in the Candyman remake. I think it was like his final role. He had like stomach cancer or something. He was... I think he was like 70. But this guy, Tony Todd, he's in...
Oh,
you
yeah.
would recognize that guy. He's been in all kinds of movies and his small roles and stuff, but he's the he was the Candyman. And yeah, I think I'm like 99%.
That would be embarrassing if he was not the Candyman at this point.
He is. He's also in all the Final Destination movies, apparently, which that I was not aware of.
I've never seen a single Final Destination movie.
He is the Candyman. Okay, I was like... I haven't either. I've just seen
I'm
clips.
Aware of like some of the like memes and tropes, but I've never actually watched one.
Yeah. Yep. But no, that's cool to hear about Clive Barker. You know, you never know with these those kind of people. You could always go one of two ways.
Over on Instagram, we had 3 votes for the book, 2 for the movie, and 1 listener who couldn't decide. And we did get a message from Tim Wahoo.
It's a real comment.
It's a real thing.
Holy
who
shit.
Said, I like Hellraiser 2 more.
Fair.
Did not elaborate on that, but.
It's fine. We'll take it.
Now we know Tim Wahoo's opinion on the Hellraiser series. I know we were all dying to know. And then over on Goodreads, we had 1 vote for the book, 0 for the movie. And Miko said, I'm just going to agree with everything you said and give my vote to the book.
Love it.
Now I'm interested to see how the rest 10 or so movies go. I suspect that the Cenobites quickly become very generic monsters as the series progresses.
That's what it sounded like based on, was it Warren's comment earlier? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is kind of what happens. I actually would be inclined to at least watch the next 2, 3, whatever.
Yeah.
To get to wherever that that story finishes. We'll have to do that next year for Halloween. But to wherever the, like, I think it was Warren said the first 4 movies.
Yeah, I think
is
the
like
first
a complete
4.
Story.
Yeah.
Because, I would be interested to see where that goes because it was interesting after this. I enjoyed this movie enough to watch the sequel. Sequels, I guess.
So our winner this week was The Book in a Landslide.
Wow.
With 9 votes to the movie's 2, plus our 1 listener who couldn't decide.
I don't know if I would have guessed that, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think I would have guessed that.
All right. That's it for our listener feedback. Thank you all very much for all your comments. If you missed out on that, too bad. You got to make sure you get those comments in on time. Katie, it's time now to preview The King's Damsel by Vera Chapman.
In an age of great hopes and daring dreams.
One day, I will be a knight, like father.
Yes, when you're old enough, Kaylee.
A brave quest.
Camelot.
Is about to begin.
I want to go on grand adventures. I want to go to Camelot.
Warner Brothers Family Entertainment presents Quest for Camelot.
Did you figure out how to pronounce this?
I did not find... So what I found was that... So it's spelled Damosel. And what I found was that is an archaic spelling of damsel.
Okay.
So I
yeah,
think the...
Yeah, it's spelling of damsel. So
I think the play is to just pronounce it damsel.
Yeah.
Even though every time I look at it, my brain goes, damosel.
Yeah. Damsel. The King's Damsel.
Yeah. The King's Damsel is a 1976 fantasy novel by British author Vera Chapman. It is part of the Three Damsels trilogy, along with her other books, The Green Knight and King Arthur's Daughter.
And interestingly, it looked like from what I was reading that it's... Oh, you have this later. Well, that it was the second one in the series.
Yeah, it's like the middle one.
Interesting, yeah.
The novel is based on Arthurian legend. It follows the story of Lynette, a character who appears in multiple Arthurian tales after she saves her sister Leonie from the Red Knight, covering the events of the original legends as a series of flashbacks and vastly expanding on Lynette's character. And those were all of the book facts that I had. But since we don't have a ton of book facts, here are a few additional fun facts about the author.
Which there also weren't quite enough of to
not quite enough of to warrant its own segment. But together, we almost have a full segment here. So Vera Chapman was a British author and founding member of the Tolkien Society.
I saw all this on her Wikipedia. I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah. Within which she also went by the name Belladonna Took.
Yes.
She was also one of the first women to graduate from Oxford University as a full member, which is cool. She was also a member of the neo-pagan group, the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, in which she held the title of Pendragon, whatever that means.
Yes.
And final fun fact, Chapman published her first book, The Green Knight, in 1975 at age 77.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And she continued to write and publish until her death in 1996 at, I believe, age 98.
Wow.
So it is never too late, y'all.
Never too late.
Never too late.
77. That's impressive. That's she published her first book past the age, like the average life expectancy of most people.
No kidding.
So good for her. All right. That was a little bit of a preview of The King's Damsel. Let's learn now a little bit about the film Quest for Camelot.
A story of wizardry and wonder. Rebels and romance, danger, and
dragons!
So scary.
An enchanted time.
Excalibur has given us the strength to stand together against all injustice.
Attack!
It's taken Excalibur!
Hey, who turned out the knight?
A dark knight.
They should get a doorbell.
No, they should get a new door.
Arthur and his kingdom will be mine.
Quest for Camelot is a 1998 film directed by Frederick Dachau, known for Racing Stripes, Underdog. It's not called Bollywood. Nah, I wrote that on there wrong. It had a different name, but anyways. Animator. Oh, and then he was also an animator on Tailspin, Tom and Jerry the Movie, and The Land Before Time 3. I believe he was the director of animation on that one. The film was written by Frank D'Amico, known for both of the Crude movies. The Ruby Gillman Teenage Kraken movie, which came out recently, I heard was pretty good.
Yeah, I heard that was good.
And Space Chimps, among other things. Also co-written by William Schifrin, known for Tough Puppy, Shaggy and Scooby-Doo Get a Clue, which is a TV show. Most of these are TV shows. He wrote episodes of The Fairly Odd Parents, Ah Real Monsters, and an episode of Frasier, which I thought was really interesting. And then two more co-writers, Jacqueline Feather, who worked wrote on the animated The King and I movie, and then David Seidler, who wrote The King's Speech, won an Oscar for The King's Speech, also wrote on The Young and the Restless, the animated The King and I. And as I went through there further back through the catalog, I realized that Seidler and Feather were co-writers, like writing team, because they were married, I found out. Up until 2008, they literally got divorced right before David wrote The King's Speech and won his Oscar.
She was holding him down.
I don't know. To be fair, he didn't do anything else after that that was like anything particularly big. And The King's Speech is kind of in movie circles considered one of the lesser best Oscar winners. Mm. But
I mean, you want to know something extremely unsurprising about that movie?
Your mom loves it.
My mom loves it. I love you, Mom.
I liked it when I saw it. I saw it in theaters when it came out, and I remember liking it, but I don't remember anything else about it. I remember going, oh, that was interesting. That was good. But yeah, I haven't revisited it. So, but it's one of those that has kind of, I like cinephiles are like, not the best picture winner or whatever. The film stars Jesselyn Gilsig, Cary Elwes, Gary Oldman, Eric Idle, Don Rickles, Jane Seymour, Pierce Brosnan, Bronson Pinchot, Jaleel White, Gabriel Byrne, and John Gielgud, among others.
Hell of a cast.
It is a crazy cast. It is a stacked cast indeed. It has a 43% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 50 on Metacritic, and a 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb. It made $38.1 million against a budget of $40 million. Mm-hmm. Very big flop. It was nominated for one Oscar for Best Music Original Song for the song The Prayer, which was performed by Celine Dion, and it did win the Golden Globe for the same category. So, The Quest for Camelot was announced in May of 1995 as Warner Brothers Feature Animation's very first project. Elizabeth Chandler, who was the co-writer on A Little Princess, which we've done, was the first screenwriter attached to the project before eventually she was replaced by Kirk D'Amico, who I mentioned earlier. The film was briefly delayed in the fall of 1995 when the animators working on the film had to be reassigned to finish Space Jam, which is another concurrent project coming out of Warner Brothers at the time. In April of 1996, Christopher Reeve was cast as King Arthur. We'll get more to why he wasn't King Arthur eventually or later. So, the original plan for the film was a much darker in tone and much more similar to animated projects like Ralph Bakshi's Wizards. That was a specific reference that Bill and Sue, that Bill Croyer specifically, who I'm going to talk about here in a second, was wanted to reference when he was making this project. But following the success of the Disney Renaissance, the studio decided, actually, we got to change this to be much more like more kid friendly, add music to it, make it more like the successful Disney movies that are coming out during this time period. And at that time, they also changed the object of the quest from the Holy Grail to Excalibur. Due to all of these changes, Bill and Sue Croyer of Ferngully fame, Bill Croyer directed and wrote Ferngully, and I believe Sue Croyer was a producer on it. Who had been attached to the film as co-director and producer, respectively, left the project. When Croyer left, several other animators also left the project, and it's from what I'm reading here, it was hard to tell how much of this was people quitting versus people being fired. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that here in a second with some quotes. But Frank Gladstone, who was the film's initial producer, was also one of the people that left the project. Effects supervisor Michael Gagne said, quote, people were giving up. The head of layout was kicked out. The head of background, the executive producer, the director, the associate producer, all the heads rolled. It's kind of a hard environment to work in. And that was why I thought it was interesting that, because even within that quote, he said people were giving up. The head of layout was kicked out, the blah, blah, blah. All these people were kicked out. All the heads rolled. It's like mixed language in there of like, were people quitting or were people being fired?
Probably a little bit of both.
Probably both, yeah. Eventually, Duchau, who I mentioned earlier as the film's director, was promoted to be the sole director because initially it was announced that him and Croyer were going to co-direct. And Christopher Reeve was replaced by Pierce Brosnan because he was unable to re-record some lines or something after some changes were made. I thought it was related to his accident, but it wasn't because he actually got cast after his accident. Mm-hmm. So, in Animation Magazine, the lead animator of the character Garrett, who is Cary Elwes's character in the movie, Crystal Klabund, said, quote, it was top heavy. All the executives were happily running around and playing executive, getting corner offices, but very few of them had any concept about animation at all, about doing an animated film. It never occurred to anybody at the top that they had to start from the bottom and build that up. The problems were really coming at the inexperience of everyone involved. Those were people from Disney that had the idea that you just said, do it, and it gets done. It never occurred to them that it got done because Disney had an infrastructure in place working like clockwork. We didn't have that. End quote.
Woof.
So the movie ultimately came in way over budget, was a huge nightmare.
Bloated mess.
Yeah, from everything I've read. As mentioned earlier, the song The Prayer, and this is IMDb getting into like two IMDb trivia facts before we get to some reviews. The song The Prayer was performed by Celine Dion in English, but in the Italian version, Andrea Bocelli, who was a very famous Italian tenor, performed the song. And now a duet that features both of them is probably the most well-known version of the song, because Celine Dion re-released that version on her 1998 Christmas album, which is both her and the Italian guy singing it together. Another random little fun fact, there's apparently a scantily clad girl who appears briefly during Devin and Cornwall's song, and that character is Red Hot Riding Hood, who's a character from Red Hot Riding Hood, a 1943 Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer cartoon.
Oh, interesting.
She's also in several other MGM cartoons from that time period. I looked at that scene to try to find what they were talking about. I couldn't see it on the YouTube version. Maybe it's not the whole scene or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but
interesting Easter egg.
Yeah, and apparently they just threw a cartoon character from MGM cartoons from the 40s in there. And finally, getting to some reviews, Owen Gleiberman for Entertainment Weekly wrote, quote, "The images are playful and serviceably lush, but the story and characters might have come out of a screenwriting software program, and the songs, sung by Celine Dion and Steve Perry, among others, are Vegas pop wallpaper," end quote. David Kroenke for the LA Times described the film as, quote, "formulaic," saying, quote, "it was a nearly perfect reflection of troubling trends in animated features." He said that Kaylee was, quote, "a standard issue spunky female heroine," and, quote, "Garrett's blindness is the one adventurous element to the film, but even it seems calculated. His lack of sight is hardly debilitating. It still provides kids a lesson in acceptance," end quote. That's a weird review. I don't know if I agree with this guy. He seems weird. I don't know if I like him. Seems like he was like, this movie's woke.
Maybe.
That's kind of what it feels like without in not so many words. I don't know. For Real Views, James Bertinelli wrote, quote, "that the film was dull, uninspired, and worst of all, characterized by artwork that could charitably be called unimpressive." Stephen Holden for the New York Times said, quote, "coming on the heels of 20th Century Fox's lush but silly Anastasia," a much better film than this one, that's his parenthetical, "Quest for Camelot suggests that Disney still owns the artistic franchise on animated features," end quote. Kevin J. Hardy, in his collection of essays titled Cinema Arthuriana, which I assume is movies about King Arthur, says the film is, quote, "slightly indebted to, rather than, as Warner Publicity claims, actually based on Chapman's novel." So the film is, quote, "slightly indebted to, rather than, as Warner Publicity claims, actually based on Chapman's novel." So he's saying not much of an adaptation, much more of a loosely inspired by.
Well, I knew it was purported to be loosely inspired. Okay. So
For the San Francisco Chronicle, Peter Stack said that the film is, quote, "a spirited adventure with generous romantic and comic charms that aims to please a range of ages with loopy gags, corny romance, and an oversized villain, and catchy tunes performed by Celine Dion and Leanne Rimes, among others." So maybe a positive review there. For Variety, Joe Lydon said that the film was, quote, "a lightweight but likable fantasy that offers a playful feminist twist to Arthurian legends," and said, quote, "the animation, though not quite up to Disney standards, is impressive enough on its own terms to dazzle the eye and serve the story." And finally, I had to go find Ebert's review on his website, I should do this more often because I get to take more of the review, because Wikipedia usually throws one sentence in there.
Yeah.
But when I go to this thing, I can actually pull a bunch of pull quotes out. Ebert gave the film 2 out of 4 stars, saying, quote, "the animation isn't vivid, the characters aren't very interesting, and the songs are routine. Quest for Camelot, like so many animated features, is a template onto which superficially new characters are plugged. I'm not putting the formula down. Done well, it can work, and some version of these ingredients now seems to be required in all feature-length animated films. But Quest for Camelot does a fuzzy job of clearly introducing and establishing its characters and makes them types, not individuals. Will kids like it? I don't know. I saw it in a theater filled with kids and didn't hear or sense the kind of enthusiasm that good animation can inspire. The movie's underlying formula is so familiar that there's no use bothering with a retread unless you have compelling characters and good songs. Enormous resources went into the making of this film, why wasn't there more stretching and creativity at the screenplay level? Why work so hard on the animation and run the plot on autopilot?" End quote. So Ebert was not largely impressed, but not terrible. 2 out of 4 stars isn't the worst review in the world. As always, you can do us a favor by heading over to Facebook, Threads, Instagram, Blue Sky, Goodreads, any of those places interact. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check us out on patreon.com/thisfilmislit and drop us a nice little rating and a review on any of the platforms you listen to us. Katie, where can people watch Quest for Camelot?
As always, you can check with your local library. We did procure a DVD copy of this movie from our library.
We'll see. We'll try it if it works. It was so often the DVDs we get just do not work. But
Or if you have a local video rental store, you can check with them. Otherwise, you can stream this for free through Hoopla. So if your library has access to Hoopla, which ours unfortunately does not, you can do that. Or you can rent it for around $4 through Amazon, YouTube, Apple TV, or Fandango at home.
Sweet. The main thing I'm excited, I normally say I'm excited. This time I don't know how excited I am. But I will say this, I'm excited to see if this is a movie I remember. That's my main thing. I'm like so interested to see if, like, as we talked about at the end of the last episode, of like, man, I feel like I might remember this movie, but maybe I won't. I have no idea.
I'm pretty sure I've never seen this movie.
Yeah,
I think I would remember like something about it if I had.
Mm-hmm.
But I am interested because most of what I have like seen and read of it leads me to suspect that it's not going to be very good.
Yeah, that's what it seems
like. So I am interested to see if it's like not good in kind of a fun way or in an interesting way, or if it's just kind of boring.
We shall see. That'll be in 1 week's time. Come on a journey. Let us know. You know, we're going to all find out together if this movie is boring or not. But until that time, guys, gals, non-binary pals, and everybody else,
keep reading books,
keep watching movies,
and keep being awesome.